Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to tonight's podcast from Prague. I'm Pete Coleman.
And I'm Travis Dow. Today we're going to talk about Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler. Now, this one's been a long time coming. This has relevance to both the Bohemian and the History of Alchemy podcast because Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler kind of did a lot of things in Prague. They may have become famous partially outside of Prague before and after, but in Prague, in particular, they were a duo, and this is a fascinating time of history. We have, just to give you some background of what else was going on at the same time, we have like Copernicus around 1543. This is the time of Shakespeare, Elizabeth I of England, Galileo, not much after this. This is the same time as Yesenius, who we mentioned in one of the Bohemian podcasts. He's one of the executed noblemen in Prague. And Kepler actually went to Prague with Yesenius when Yesenius ended his visit at Brahe in Banatki. So, like, it's Yesenius is he was a professor of medicine and a very important kind of Protestant rebel that led up to the 30 Years' War. This is a great time in Prague, but also a great time within Europe right before the 30 Years' War. And then, of course, as it seems like we mention in every episode, this is the time of Sendivogius, the famous alchemist, and none other than Rudolf II, who's the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He's the one that eventually brings them both to Prague, and it's thanks to him that they work together in the first place. You know, one more thing I want to say before we kind of launch into this is that this is a bit of a longer podcast. I had to read a couple of books to get all the information I wanted for this podcast. So normally we don't really give you a table of contents, but just so you know what to expect, we're going to talk about Kepler and Tycho's theories, which are very cool, so we're going to go into them, and Kepler's kind of horoscope predictions, Brahe's moose, and his crazy nose.
Drunk moose. Right.
Some highlights to look forward to, and Kepler's mother's witch trial. So if some parts stretch on a little bit long or get a little bit theoretical or, if we're droning on a little bit about the science, just keep those in mind that there's some crazy bits dispersed in between. So
what's interesting about this original odd couple of Brahe and Kepler is the fact that you would think that the science brought them together in the sense that they had a lot in common. When in reality, they just didn't on so many different levels. But I think they were looking for truth. Their concept of truth in mathematics and astronomy and astrology. Kepler had a kind of combination of that. They found success in that partnership. And if there was a place and a time that fit well to this dynamic friendship and partnership, it would have been under Rudolf's Prague. At this time and at this location. So if I can just say that the stars aligned correctly, if I can use that,
sure.
It really did in this sense.
Yeah, in fact, they almost had nothing in common. But one of the things they did have is that they had revolutionary ideas, and they were challenging the mainstream ideas of the time. And even though they didn't agree with each other all the time, their theories combined in great ways. I mean, one would not have been as great without the other. So even though they had very little in common, I mean, we'll get into this, but Brahe was Catholic, Kepler was Lutheran, Brahe was filthy rich, Kepler barely scraped by.
A noble family, but yes, was basically impoverished in
many ways. He had some distant noble relatives, but whereas Brahe was, you know, a couple of steps away from the throne.
Yeah, well-connected guy.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, why don't you – let's get started. We'll start with Brahe because he's older. So we'll go in a vague chronological sense. We'll start with Brahe. We'll go to where they both met and the theories they did together, and then we'll finish with some of with basically Kepler, because he lived much longer than Brahe did time-wise. So yeah, why don't you give us a rundown on you know, who was Tycho Brahe?
Tycho Brahe, a Dane, a nobleman, really had, came from a lot of wealth, well connected, as you said, Travis. You know, really had a focus on trying to find things with the camp of astronomy. Now, at the time, you have to understand that there were several different warring camps, the world of astronomy, apart from astrology. Some of these things kind of bled together a little bit at this time, but for the most part, there were two different camps, pretty much separated by mathematics and mathematic theory, and what they put their focus on, how the celestial bodies moved during the encampment of astronomy. So when you look at Brahe, you see that he actually had an observatory at the time, one of the very first buildings ever built, and largest in Europe at modern times, to have an astronomical observation as a major criteria built into his blueprint, and an alchemist's lab in the cellar. So we can bring in that alchemy aspect into Brahe, can't we?
Yeah, it'll come up a couple of times, but yeah, you know, it doesn't take much to qualify someone for the History of Alchemy podcast, but he was technically also an alchemist, which is all I need to know to have a mention.
So he's in the club.
But yeah, well, even astrology plays a very important role, and both Kepler and Brahe were astrologers, although mainly possibly just to pay the bills. So they both maybe didn't actually believe in horoscopes, but they did write them and read them. We'll actually go into a little bit of detail of Uraniborg, the first building built with the observatory or with an observatory in mind, but that thing is crazy. Like, every detail of that almost, it's more than a chateau. It was a castle, and it's just...
Well, he planned the inner workings insane, with the right? idea of his experiments.
Oh yeah.
So then he built it around this.
Yeah, it is a huge laboratory first and foremost that you just happen to be able to live very comfortably in. And yeah, I mean, we'll go into detail of that. But there's some more details you can speak about here.
Yeah, because... you know, it's kind of sad in some respect, in the sense that here's this extremely intelligent pioneer. In his discipline, and what many people know of him through quick tour guide books when they come to Prague, or just in general, is the fact that he lost his nose in a fencing duel.
Yeah,
and that he had a prosthetic nose made for him so that he wouldn't stick out in a crowd, or make people sick to their stomach. You know, when you lose your cartilage of your nose, it's kind of
looks pretty gruesome.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. But you know, he did lose part of his nose in a duel, and you have to understand, folks, when people were dueling for their honor, and in this particular situation, he was dueling with Mandra Parsberg over the legitimacy over a mathematical formula. So you have two basically mathletes, math mm-hmm. nerds going at it, because one said one didn't equal to the other.
What a thing to get in a duel over.
I know, exactly. But you know, this it led to your honor, so it had to be done. You know, during the Middle Ages, it was really important for people to have these duels to protect their honor. Some actually rented out professional duelists because they mm-hmm. weren't very good at the art of dueling. Others decided to take it a matter in their own hands, but too many were dying from losing these battles. And of course, the people that were willing to protect their honor were the ones that you're going to want to use in the battles and the crusades.
Well, yeah, one thing I didn't realize, but I looked up the meaning of these duels and the meaning of honor. And one thing I was totally ignorant of before I read this was that honor was almost a physical thing, because if someone insulted you, it was tied to nobility strictly. So
sure.
the peasants did not have honor. In fact, they sometimes weren't allowed to have swords. They weren't allowed to have duels anyways. But I did not realize that if someone threatened your honor and you did not back it up, then you could actually lose your status. You could lose your wealth and nobility. Because and this could go either to the king or possibly the pope. I mean, this could get escalated, and they would say, hey, he did not back up his honor. He's not worthy of his honor, and therefore he's not worthy of his title. I didn't know that. See, I thought they were all just kind of stubborn, uppity, you know, European noblemen saying, oh, how dare you insult my mother? You know, we're going to fight to the death. No, if they did not do that, they could lose everything.
Well, it would also affect future generations. as well. Right. This stuff did carry on to your kids. So you had to do this, even if it meant losing your life. Now, here's the thing. During the many Crusades, several popes were concerned about losing their best and their brightest warriors due to these, you know, frivolous duels. And so they actually called a mandate, a law, saying that you can't kill anymore. So you have to draw first blood. Your honor is rewarded if you draw first blood. And that's the end of the duel. All right. This is where the word epée comes from the epi layer of your skin. So the modern fencing that we see in the Olympics, one of the three weapons, is called an epée for that one reason. So that, you know, you draw first blood, this is done. But to take someone's nose, now, folks, when you take someone's nose, you mean business, man. You're meaning to mutilate somebody for the rest of their lives over a mathematic equation. Brahe was on the wrong end of the sword in this situation, and he had to live with a false nose for the rest of his life. Now, some of that was, you know, is that really true? Did that really happen? So Brahe, you know, was in a situation where he needed to still fit in society with this mutilation that he had to get over. Now, at the time, if he was living in India, they were doing skin grafts. You know, through the Pottery Guild, they were able to make this happen so that things like this would not be so obvious out in public. But he wasn't in India. He was in Europe. So no such luck. It was said through tradition that his nose apparatus, the apparatus or the prosthetic, was made of gold, silver, copper, maybe bronze. No one really kind of knew. There's been other portraits done with him where it was obvious, you know, that it was there. Others that you maybe just see a thin line, giving you an idea that maybe
that was the statue in Prague.
Exactly. You can see a thin line. Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. And so he might have covered up with maybe a foundation base, you know, a makeup to make sure that you didn't see the metal workings of this. But keep in mind, gold is heavy, all right? So being able to stick something to your nose, to your face, it's a fake nose, is hopefully doesn't drop off in the middle of doing something. Imagine bad news. Just bad news altogether. And you lose your credibility. I mean, you can be an extremely intelligent mathematician, but when your nose falls off during your lectures, you lose some credibility. Yeah. So he needed to keep it on it. And so we had all these kind of ideas about what the nose was made of, but just as an aside, In June 24th of 1901, his body was exhumed, and they found a thin little layer of green around the nose of his skull. And so people then theorized that it was mostly probably made of copper, which would make sense. Copper is, you know, still pretty good metal at the time, but a little bit lighter, of course. But in 2010, just recently, here in Prague, at the Church of Tien, in Old Town Square, his body was exhumed again, and they analyzed the small bone fragments and declared that it was actually brass.
Yeah.
So this was also most likely kept in place with glue. Here's my question to you, Travis. Much like a 21st century rap star artist, music artist that might wear gold teeth to give you a sense of you know, how well off they are.
You're saying he was showing some bling?
He was showing some nose bling. You know, you never know. Maybe at the really special occasions, everybody knew he lost a nose.
Yeah.
So maybe it was a situation where he went to a big dinner with Rudolph and he said, "Hey, I'm gonna let it shine."
Well, that's the thing is that. I think you mentioned that in some portraits you see a string, like in a World War I mask, but in many portraits you see nothing at all. You just see him with a regular nose. And I don't know if that was like the portraitist being polite or because I've read that he had a silver and gold nose. I also read that he used a lot of foundation. So actually maybe you didn't see anything. It's hard to say because the portraits don't all agree with each other. So, and we didn't have photography. So
and this is just a little sidebar of just something that he had to live with for the rest of his life. But really, when you look at the genius of this man and you look at how he manifested this genius, what really comes out to me is not so much the loss of this duel, but so much of what we talked about several minutes ago with the creationist observatory and what he did with this alchemist lab.
Yeah.
You know, and how he really kind of mixed several different disciplines. We're talking about astronomy, astrology, mixture of alchemy in there.
You know what? Let me get into one of these houses. So we mentioned Oranienburg, which he built later, but one of the first ones I want to mention is his house on Hven. He had an observatory on an island, and we'll kind of go into all these, but his house on Hven, which is awesome, it is just very coolly done. It's almost too many details for me to go into here, but I'll give you guys an overview. It did have an alchemist lab. It had, as an example, so I mean, he built it from the ground up with all kind of details in mind. For instance, you know, he was a social creature. He had very many important guests over, and one example of this is, so he had students, like apprentices, that would, you know, help him with his star charts and help him with his readings and everything. And one thing he did is he had cables going to each of the students' rooms attached to bells, okay? And they all came to, like, the living room where he would entertain his guests. But they were kind of discreetly hidden. So what he would do is he would, when the guests weren't paying attention, he would yank on one of these chains, so calling the student. And then when he would presumably hear the student in the hallway, he would whisper his name, be like, Sven, you know? And then, bam, in an instant, that student would knock on the door. And the guest would be like, oh, my God. You know, I mean, it's sorcery, you know? and he would, you know, the students would just magically appear, and all the guests' faces would just be astounded. Like,
could you imagine the students probably rolling their eyes going, yes, sir.
Yeah.
I mean, we know all the tricks.
Mr.
Ring the bell, I come. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, he had all these crazy, kooky things. That's just one of the ones that stuck out to me, so I put that in here. But in Uraniborg, what we mentioned earlier was, so this is in the middle of the island of, you know, he was a nobleman, so he had his peasants and everything that did a lot of work for him. In fact, in some stories, he was kind of a tyrant, but this was the best observatory at the time, and everything was built in this specific kind of structure. So everything was symmetric and geometrical. So it was like a square with circles on the outsides. And then he had kind of satellite observatories. One was like named Sterneborg, which is like, you know, Starberg, basically. And he would have, because they wouldn't fit in the house, because some of his equipment would be like 2-3 stories tall. So he would have to dig into the ground, and this would be like straight north of the main house or straight west or straight east or whatever, and dig into the ground 2 or 3 floors, and then have this huge like sextant or some, you know, astronomical tool. But he had to have this huge like compass or sextant or something, you know, to observe the stars. And so he'd be at like ground level, and this huge instrument is going way beneath ground, but also looking up in the heavens. You know, just to give you an example of the scale of these things. And you know, he would keep commissioning more and more tools, and, you know, kind of spreading out his observatory into all these little satellite observatories. And these were all not just massively precise tools, but also made of like bronze and gold, and with murals on the side, murals that would be like 2-3 stories tall, because that's how tall the tools were. And these really not just precise instruments, but absolutely works of art in their own right. And we'll get into some of these, but just keep in mind that if we talk about him moving from Denmark or from his island to Copenhagen or to Germany or to Prague, he had most of these in tow. So he would have like a caravan of instruments behind him.
A posse of students and helpers. And you know, I think, and this might be too inside, Travis, and I don't know if you've read anything on this, but when you talk about his observatory and looking into the stars, what were the lenses like? Because at the time, you know, lens technology and invex lenses and
he didn't have lenses.
Convex, he didn't have any lenses.
So this is...
How could he do this without lenses?
This is around the same time as Galileo. So Kepler got into optics and lenses, but this is a little bit before. Or when it... Either before or when it was just too spanking new to get to him. So these were sights, as in like sights from a rifle. No lenses, no telescopes.
Interesting.
And he had partially more precise instruments than later telescopes had. I mean, that's why they were so big, because you had to line up the sights, you know, from, you know, let's say, I don't know, 30 yards, 10 meters, whatever. I mean, a huge one to the other, and then you get these super precise measurements that he would, you know, then make his students write down, and night after night, and he would track Mars. One of his big projects was tracking Mars and tracking the planets. But let's take a break from that. Let's get into some of the funny things. I'll mention one thing, which is he had a dwarf jester named Jep. I'm just going to go with that. Why don't you tell us about the moose?
the moose is the best story. You sure you want me to tell this?
Go
story?
For it. All right. Man, go for it.
All right. If you
like, this is the best part.
This is the best part. All right. He actually had a tame moose. It was actually really an elk, but we're going to call him a moose.
There could be something lost in translation.
A very large animal with a funny nose and some antlers.
Let's go with that.
Okay. And it was meant for noblemen and castle, but died of drinking too much beer, and found his demise after falling down a flight of stairs. So he had a drunk moose, and this is actually a true story.
Yeah, this story gets thrown around a lot. Like, this is like, oh, you know, clearly the guy with the nose and the moose. But yeah, like, someone in Kassel asked for something called a reek. He's like, I know in the north you guys have these deer-like animals called reeks. And Brahe was like, I don't know what a reek is. I think he just made it up, or, you know.
Like
just
a snipe.
It's just a legend. Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah.
And he's like, we have reindeer. Do you mean reindeer? And he's like, no. I have several reindeer. It's too hot for them. They all died. And Brahe was like, well, I know a guy with a couple of elk. He's like, well, I already have some elk. But if you offered an elk, I wouldn't refuse an elk. So that's exactly how it went down.
Conversation at a dinner table.
It's this is exactly how it went down. Like, these noblemen writing letters back and forth.
And if he could drink a lot of pivo, he's my new pet.
So Brahe arranged an elk, and then he went up some stairs into the house and got into a beer keg, and he drank the whole thing, basically. And then on his way down, he tripped, fell, and died, you know? So,
life expectancy of Brahe's pets really was very limited. This is probably what the lessons learned here. Smart guy, but was not good with animal husbandry. Is what you're trying to tell me here.
Yeah, put some elk gates on your stairwells. I don't know.
Or don't have reindeer in the middle of summer. Yeah, there's things to learn from this.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It wasn't all just goofy stuff. Actually, a lot of him is kind of goofy.
Yeah, we started the show with goofy.
Yeah,
but now we're kind of getting to the meat, right?
There's more goofy coming, but he might have possibly named the sextant. So, you know, this tool looks kind of like a compass, and so that he might have actually named it. Now, his theories are really interesting. We'll get into it a little bit deeper in a second here, but it's a mix of Ptolemaic. So the tools that he had and why he wasn't satisfied was because for him to read horoscopes or to predict things, he had a mix of Ptolemaic and Copernican tables available to him. So Ptolemaic is the old geocentric model of the universe, and Copernican was newer, but he, even with the Copernican model, he still noticed that there was huge indiscrepancies of where a prediction said a planet would be or a star would be and where it actually was, because no one had as precise a measurement as he did. So he could instantly tell, well, that's not right either. Okay, so he tried to come up with theories that would make sense of his own readings. Now, there's some interesting things going on, because Brahe was a nobleman, and noblemen, it was beneath them to actually publish intellectual books. It was not their place in society. So it's all fun and games that he can observe stuff. But to actually publish something, that was not okay. So it was like a party trick. You know, he could with his other nobility at a, you know, drinking and eating feasts and whatnot, what noblemen did, it was fine for him to say, huh, Ptolemy, he has it all wrong, and Copernicus also, I know what's best, that's fine. But then to actually publish his works, that was not okay. But, you know, it was just beneath him. He didn't, you know, it just wasn't his place. But this all changed when the 1572 supernova happened. Now, supernova, that was actually, he coined the term, okay? So it's now called SN 1572, and it's in the constellation Cassiopeia. Since antiquity, and we're talking like back the Aristotle and Ptolemaic system, you know, the world is the center of the universe, okay? And the moon cycle, everything revolves around the Earth, and basically, what is closer than the moon can change. It's you know, you have, I mean, we see it all around us. You have life and death. You see trees growing. You see trees dying. You see people growing, being born, and dying. So anything closer than the moon can change, okay? The moon changes, phases. But anything beyond the moon was unchangeable. So planets move, but they don't change. And stars are eternal. So the word for sky and heaven is often the same word in many, many languages. And so the idea is that the stars never change. Now, what if you have a supernova? What happens? This only happens like every, I don't know, a couple hundred years, every thousand years. I mean, it's really, really rare. So what do you have if something beyond the moon changes? So everybody at the time, the supernova happened, and everybody's saying, oh, well, it has to be a comet because it has to be closer than the moon. Anything further can't change. It cannot be a new star. And Brahe was reading these books and at the same time observing it and was saying, no, you have something called parallax, which is when a comet changes, if you're rotating, you can see that it changes in the sky. Okay, so basically I don't want to get things mixed up here, but in the summer and winter, if you're on opposite ends of the sun's orbit, you can see a parallax in certain things. In stars, we didn't discover this parallax until like the 70s of this century, because it's so tiny.
The 20th century?
Yeah, because of last century, I should say, yeah. Because the stars are so far away, you don't see the parallax. I mean, it looks like they are eternal. But the supernova, if it was closer than the moon, you should be able to see it moving relative to the stars. But it wasn't. It was a star. And so, you know, he figured all this out. And he finally, the king actually told him, you know what, you should publish what you have because this will be great for Denmark. You know, we have this star astronomer here. You know, let's publish this. So he published a book. In this book, just to give you a quote, so he presented it as a super wonder. And to give you a quote here, he said, "I doubted no longer in truth. It was the greatest wonder that has ever shown itself in the whole of nature," as in the star being born, "since the beginning of the world, or in any case, as great as when the sun was stopped by Joshua's prayers." So he recognized that, okay, this is, you know, once in a millennium event, and it's wonderful, but this is really what it is. It is a new star. So he coined the term nova. So the term nova, we get that from Brahe. He wrote a book, De Stella Nova, like of the new star. And now we call it a supernova. And so when you hear nova or supernova, now you know who to thank, all right? He almost didn't publish, like I said, but when he just, you know, he saw how inept all the other descriptions were, he talked it over with the king, and the king said, oh yeah, you got to publish this. This is, you know, all this other stuff that's going on, that's just quackery. They assume it has to be a comet because Aristotle said it has to be a comet, but it's obviously not what's happening, right? Then he published the book, and then later he started even lecturing, which was even a step lower than publishing a book. But, the king and his peers just felt that, okay, you know, he has enough knowledge and intelligence that it would just be wasted if he just shared it in his noble circles. So he lectured. He became a teacher of sorts.
Well, let me give you a little side note to this as well. We're talking about this happening in 1572, correct? Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine, a little further inland into Europe, there's a young Johannes Kepler, a very young kid. His mother knew that he loved astronomy. Mm-hmm. That was his penchant that he wanted to follow. That was what he wanted to do. And because of a motherly love of basically trying to keep her son's attention into something that he really liked, she took him out to the country to watch this particular supernova, what they thought was a comet at the time in 1572. Yep. So at the same time that Brahe was actually making scientific gains with this discovery, a very young Kepler was blossoming into his interest in astronomy right then and there.
Yeah, and
kind of a neat sort of connection between the two.
Yeah, it's funny. This is, of course, I don't believe in astrology, but it is very interesting that these two astrologers, like you said earlier, the stars aligned. This is truly a big coincidence. So the last supernova before this, which wasn't even noted in Europe, Europeans didn't even notice it, basically, was what the Chinese called a guest star, which was in 1006. So basically 1,000 years ago almost. And then there was Tycho's in 1572. And then Kepler got his turn in 1604. And then there's been none since.
Yeah, amazing.
So, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it really was very rare phenomena, and there was two within, you know, basically 32 years of each other.
And these two men were you know, joined together in scientific discovery through the latter part of their careers, or at least through Brahe's career, together. So they had that in common with each other in an interesting way.
Okay, so why don't you talk a little bit about the Tychonic system? Let's talk about what he believed in.
Tychonic system basically means this, that all planets revolve around the sun, but the sun and the moon revolve around the Earth.
Yep. So right? The Earth is still
the center of everything. This fits very well into the Catholic or church belief system at the time, that because our divinity, that God created Earth, that we have to be the center of the universe. We have to be the center of our solar system. And that's it. The idea is that Earth still has a center seat at galaxy center.
Yeah.
And its own importance. Yet the sun has its center as well. And this is all based on the idea that why he was so stuck on this idea was because of that the parallax idea of there's no stellar parallax.
Right.
So there's a measurement issue that he just said the stars do not move.
Well, I mean, it all makes sense from their standpoint.
Absolutely.
Because he had the most precise instrument at the time. And he said, if the Earth is revolving around the sun, like Copernicus said, and many people were already on the
Copernicus. On board with him. Yeah.
Copernicus. I mean, this is already Galileo's time. Mm-hmm. Galileo wasn't famous quite at this moment, but he was rising. And Galileo was a strong Copernican, you know, advocate, obviously. But still, he said, okay, so I have the most precise measurements ever, and I do not see the stars moving. Now, his problem is that everybody at the time greatly, greatly underestimated how far away the stars were.
Right.
In the Earth's orbit, if you're at one end of the orbit and then the other, according to how far they thought the stars were away, you should see the stars move. You don't see them move, the Earth simply doesn't move. End of story. Okay? But then he was also smart enough to realize that, like you said, the planets are clearly not revolving around the Earth. That makes no sense. They're revolving around the sun.
Right.
So it's
he had to meld two together to make sense.
But it's still based off of observation. I mean,
Listen, this is a step that had to be made. It had to be made so we can move even further into this.
Yeah, and another thing that's interesting is you mentioned religion, and because a lot of this, so this was like, you know, Ptolemy and Aristotle. I mean, the geocentric model goes way back to antiquity, but the Catholics took hold of it, and not just the Catholics, but if you have, if you're into astrology, and Kepler and Brahe were, if you change the model of the solar system, then you're messing with the meaning of astrology also. So it's kind of underrepresented or underestimated, but that was important. I know yesterday we just did a podcast where you mentioned the story, but it is about Brahe. So why don't you say it again?
This story actually gives you an idea about why he left Denmark. he left pretty much in the middle of the night, and this is for the reason. At the time, you know, you kind of wore different hats. You were, as we said, Brahe actually did the lowest thing he could probably do, which is teach class. He also authored books. But one of the other hats that you had to wear in society was if you're going to have all this money coming to you from the royal house, every once in a while, you had to be invited to the king's castle and perform some royal duties, which would be performing a horoscope reading. He was actually was ushered to the castle for Prince Christian of Denmark, and he wrote 71 pages of this horoscope, but of this concept. But he also knew that if the royal clock was as much off by 4 minutes at the time of the birth, then the horoscope reading would be absolutely useless.
So this, 71 pages of paperweight.
Paperweight.
But 20 pages of that horoscope were actual star charts. So he said, okay, here's the most precise things we know about the stars. So based off of these 20 pages, I'll write you another 50 pages of horoscope. But mind you, if your clocks are off 4 minutes,
it means nothing.
It's garbage.
Right. So at the time when Christian became king and took over the throne from his father, he did not share the same sort of love for this mysticism that he probably called Brahe's science.
There was a lot of money going towards Brahe.
Right. And, you know, when you look at the – you have the royal comptroller come to your to your chambers and say, hey, King, here's the deal. Brahe, we're spending a lot of gold talons on this guy. We're spending a lot of our treasury to fund this guy to tell us that your horoscopes are kind of off and they really don't mean anything. And by the by, he's just kind of – you know, fooling around with these crazy ideas.
What exactly is he doing with chopping down our forests to stoke his alchemical furnaces? And
Things didn't go so well after that. At that point, the clash of egos came in the way, and Brahe, trying to be the smarter man in the room, decided that time was up and he needed to get out of Denmark quickly. So he took all his stuff. He took all his works, he took his students and his posse, basically, and he left town left the island of Hven and left Denmark and started his life elsewhere.
Yep, started headed south a little bit. I'll note that it's around this time when he received a copy of a book by a young district mathematician named Johannes Kepler. So this is kind of almost... you know, a side, like a footnote. But this is the first time we ever heard the name Kepler. And so why don't we actually kind of talk about who Kepler was? But this is when a young Kepler was starting to make an appearance in the intellectual world.
He was born in southern Germany near Stuttgart, and he's 25 years younger than Brahe. So definitely... Kepler knew of Brahe growing up, especially that was one of his interests when he talked about astronomy. And we are kind of getting an idea that at some point after Kepler came into his own, that he made waves enough to catch Brahe's attention. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we need to understand at the time that if you were growing up, especially in a Protestant household in southern Germany, that you were going to... probably still have religion as part of your educational system. And I believe that religion basis still had colored some of the ideas that Kepler had, even when it came to the sciences.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll mention that. So he studied in Tübingen, and he was already noted for being good at horoscopes at that point. He had a professor named Mestlin, and the university officially taught the Ptolemaic system, but Mestlin was one of the few of his time that actually thought that Copernicus should be paid attention to and kind of, you know, listened to. There's also Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, who came a century before, and he also had ideas that the Earth was not motionless in the center, but, you know, kind of moving, and Kepler came across his works too. So he definitely had some influence and some ideas of the world possibly moving, which was, you know, a unique viewpoint at the time. Now, it's interesting you mentioned the kind of religion into all this, because Kepler was definitely theologically minded. And just as you mentioned that the church, there were some theological aspects of the earth not moving, and, you know, that the stars were eternal and that kind of thing, Kepler took his idea very similar to ancient Pythagoreans and reinterpreted it for Christianity. Okay, so since the sun was the brightest object in creation, it only made sense that it signified the center and should therefore be in the center of the solar system, right? So man is, you know, out, you know, not as bright as God, so we shouldn't be in the center. I mean, this all made sense to him, or this is how he reinterpreted it. Just a quote that he said is that there was nothing I could state that I could also contradict. And this comes over and over and over. So he could always show both sides of the coin. So just like he could argue for the earth being in the center, if he was pressed, he could argue for the sun being in the center. You know, either way, this kind of hurt him politically later on. I mean, he was in a charged environment between Protestants and Catholics. You know, he was, like you mentioned, a Protestant Lutheran mathematician, but he became the schoolmaster in Graz, which was very Catholic at the time. During this mathematical time, he had a reputation for using astronomy to predict crops and wars. which actually came true, because I think if you just, you know, listen to the political goings on of the time, you could predict these things pretty easily, even without reading the stars. But, you know, so he succeeded. Just to give you an example, he had to compile the calendar for the next year, and he had to give the astrological predictions. One time he predicted like things like war, disease, weather, when there'd be good times for surgery, when one should anticipate religious or political upheaval, and when the Turks would attack. Now is probably a very good time to mention that Kepler most probably did not believe in horoscopes. So people always, I get that question quite a bit actually, like here and there is, you know, so okay, so they both read horoscopes, but they're also astronomers. So did they actually buy into it? Did they believe it? What, you know, what did they personally believe? He called it feeding the fatheads superstitions. You know, so it was like the ugly daughter of astronomy was astrology, which made him very different than his contemporaries, okay?
You know, that's true, Travis. I think he wanted to distance himself from the concepts of doing horoscopes, but he wasn't completely divulged from completely separated from the idea, because he did still pay attention to the stars on his wedding date. Many people kind of wanted to have an idea about what life was going to bring after this union. So he did pay attention to that, and he has also been known for reading horoscopes and the imperial court. And the fact that he had written horoscopes when he was at university, and he was known for being very good at doing this craft. Mm-hmm. For an example, in 1595, he predicted a very harsh winter, which of course would affect crop growth. He had predicted the attack from the Turks from the south and a peasant uprising that came from all this. All this came true.
You know what? Let me tell you something though. It's possible that he kind of maybe believed in them in some bit, but let me tell you, if I lived in Austria, I could also predict a harsh winter. And if the Turks were on their way, I could also predict...
It wouldn't be rocket science.
This was a time between Protestants and Catholics, yeah, I could probably predict a peasant uprising too.
Right.
But yeah.
He was very astute. Yeah. And when you say he could read the tea leaves, I don't think he necessarily had to read tea leaves for this. He just probably just put his ear to the ground and
listen to the news.
Yeah, listen to the news. But you know, he also looked at planetary motion. What was very interesting is the fact that when we talk about that odd couple between Brahe and Kepler, Kepler believed that planetary motions traveled in ellipses, not circles, like Copernicus' mm-hmm. theory.
So, right. Yeah. That was revolutionary.
That was revolutionary thought. One of the other prophecies that was very interesting that has a connection to our city of Prague is the prophecy of Wallenstein. Wallenstein was a big general here during the 30 Years' War, and he was more powerful militarily than any emperor. And mm-hmm. you can still see that his connection to Prague by his sprawling palace grounds and the most prime real estate below the castle here at St. Vitus Cathedral.
Have you been there?
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
and it's right above Lestertown in Prague, and it's very, very impressive.
Yeah.
So Kepler kind of had an idea about it, foreseeing his death in a horoscope. Again, here's a guy during the 30 Years' War that's leading an army. Does he have a chance to be killed in battle? Absolutely.
Ah, but he predicted – it wasn't in battle. He predicted his assassination by one of the emperor's assassins. It was okay. And I think – I was trying to find a source for this, but I think he actually had the date right, which is – pretty impressive, because Wallenstein could have hidden in any number of castles. So yeah, that clearly is impressive.
Now, well, do you think maybe he might have been in on this?
Ooh, I don't. I don't.
That might be a conspiracy theory. But, yeah. You know, I mean, that would be interesting.
That might explain a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for every story you hear like this, that oh man, it's one in a million guess. I wonder how many he got wrong. You know,
you never hear about the wrong ones.
Exactly. It's like, oh, Kepler predicted Wallenstein's death, and it was the way he said on the same day. Okay, but how many times? You know, he had some really interesting theories of his own. So the ellipse thing that, you know, he predicted the planetary motion, and this gave him a lot of headaches. And okay, so he got that one right, and it's actually right. I mean, we still know that it's true today, that they kind of, the planets don't travel in circles, they travel in kind of, you know, an oval ellipsis, right? But he had other theories that were very strange. There's one called the Mysterios Cosmographicum. So he believed, I'm going to put a picture on the website. In fact, I think it's maybe already there, and both on History of Alchemy and Bohemican. He had a polygonal structure of the solar system, okay? Best described by that picture. But basically, he thought that God must have some geometrical plan. It's almost like a Pythagorean theory of, like, you know, geometry being divine in some way. But he noticed, so he wrote on a blackboard one day the distance between the sun and Mercury, that the distance between the sun and Venus is twice as long, and then the distance between the moon and that is twice that, and there's some ratio there. And then he noticed that if you take these polyhedrons, then you get, you know, so you, the perfect polyhedrons, right? So you have like a cube and a, you know, four-sided triangle and, you know, a five-sided, you know, polyhedron. And those, if you put one inside the other, they have the same ratios. So he were now that these polyhedrons were the perfect solids. And this is very related to Pythagorean or Platonic solids, okay? So there's the same amount. There's like, I don't know, five of them, five solids, five shapes. And he said, well, there's six planets. And so those five shapes fit in between the spheres of the six planets. It gets all really kind of weird. But, you know, to give you an example, so like what I'm talking about is like the dodecahedron, which is the 12-sided regular solid, fits right over Mars' sphere perfectly, okay? Within Earth's sphere is the icosahedron, which is the 20-sided one, and so on, okay? So you get the Platonic solids, you get, there's six planets, there's five perfect solids, it just all fit too good.
Well, he
saw divinity in this in some way.
There's a time here when mathematics was said to answer not just some things, but everything, and that went through the ideas of science, theology, in some respect. You could take Bible verses and you could start adding numerology, you know, not maybe numerology, but start adding numbers to certain Bible verses to actually figure things out.
Mathematical formula.
Take this, multiply it by this, and this was actually true. We talked about fencing at the very beginning. We talked about losing Brahe's nose doing a fencing duel. That was very popular at the time due to Moorish influence in España, that when you trained in Spain to be a good swordsman, you did it in a circle that had all these geographical sort of movements and triangles. And mm-hmm. there'd be no way for anybody to beat you, to stab you or to get you, because you could parry every thrust if you follow these mathematical symbols. It would be perfect.
And they were almost like given to you by God. I mean,
right.
Like some divine,
and they were great until you met somebody from maybe another country that didn't care about this, picked up some dirt, threw it in your face, and stabbed you through the heart.
Yeah.
They didn't care a lick about mathematics.
Right.
So we all kind of know that there's some problems with those kind of ideas. But at this time, mathematics could solve everything.
Well, yeah. I mean, in Kepler's case, he originally wanted to be a theologian. To give you, and so he saw God in all of his theories. To give you one more example from the Mysterium Cosmographicum, for instance, he thought that the universe itself was an image of God. Okay, so the sun corresponding to the Father, the stellar sphere, which would be the sun, as in Jesus, and the intervening space, the Holy Spirit, which is very strange, but it's kind of got some Platonic ideas in there. Which we talked in other episodes. And this is also, I think I mentioned this, but just in case, this is also how we could justify saying the sun is in the middle, not the earth, because the Father is in the middle. So we are mere humanity. Why would we be in the middle when something more brighter, more divine is in the center, right? So it's almost like a sun god religion again, you know? Like, who are we if there's this bright mass in the center? So he did justify everything theologically. But people were paying attention to his theories. In fact, Galileo actually wrote to Kepler, and Kepler replied. They were, you know, talking about Copernicus, obviously. So they were in the same time period, and I find that fascinating. And then, unlike Brahe, Kepler, you know, in the end started using optics and stuff, and we'll talk about that. But give me another example of a weird theory that he had that is kind of interesting.
Now, one of the other theories that was is actually amazing is the concept of musical harmony that Kepler had. You know, keep in mind that he had an idea the planets traveled at different speeds. Of course, he didn't have the idea that was later found out about inertia and the slingshot theory around, you know, around the sun, about why things are in an elliptical, not circular issue.
Can I just point out that the idea of inertia existed at the time? So if he would have spoken a little bit longer with Galileo,
they could have figured this out before Newton.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. And we would have a concept, a much earlier idea of gravity and what that pull means to have inertia and power to move things around. And so this whole idea of gravity, Kepler called the Holy Spirit force. So he had a conceptual idea of this.
It was like, again, on the tip of his tongue.
He brought it back into a religious concept because that was his wheelhouse. That's what he knew. So he called it the Holy Spirit force. Think of that as the gravity. So it's kind of a neat idea in that sense. He noticed that the ratios of the distance of the planets all and the speed all fit very well together, and that this would actually sound very harmonious if they were all put together in corresponding string lengths. If you could think of like a giant harp, right? You know, that certain string lengths will give you a certain type of different vibration and a velocity of sound. So the interval between Saturn and Jupiter would be a fourth. Jupiter to Mars would be an octave. Mars to Earth would be a third major, and Venus to Mercury would be a fourth. So that would kind of give you an idea that he was trying to take what he knew in a hormonal sort of idea with an instrument or string length and tension, and put a spin on it that matched well with his idea of astronomy and science.
Yeah,
this theory jived a bit better with Copernican observations than it did with the polyhedral theory, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say that the ratios fit even better. So I mean, he dug these ratio things.
But can you get the kind of the excitement that you're seeing here?
You know, what he wrote did have an influence on Pascal and Leibniz, Monge and Poncelet. He had, for instance, he had the one of his theories, or one of the things he wrote about, was the point of infinity. So if you have a straight line that goes on forever and ever, it will eventually meet having the properties of a huge circle. Okay, and these ideas were actually taken by later mathematicians and formally proven in some way or other. And he did, you know, the musical harmony, the polygon theory, it sounds kind of kooky, but he pointed at gravity without actually describing it or without actually calling it what it is. But he was also the first to publish a description of hexagonal symmetry of snowflakes. Okay, there you go. He did some real science in the sense of astronomically. We mentioned Kepler's nova, which was in 1603. But, okay, to give you both sides of the coin here, so he described the second supernova known to Europe, right, in 1604. But here's the interesting bit that brings it back to kind of mysticism and a little bit of weird stuff, is because at that time, there's something called a fiery trigon, which had an 800-year cycle. So it starts with the birth of Christ, then 800 years later you get Charlemagne, okay? And then 800 years later, what? Now it's 16-something, so they're expecting something great. And then the supernova happens, and they're like, oh, okay, that's the omen of something great to happen. It's like the Star of Bethlehem, you know? Something really cool going to happen. Okay, so let's kind of wrap up his solo life. I got one more story to tell, and then we'll kind of move on to the meeting in Prague finally. But this story is a doozy. So around 1611, Kepler circulated a manuscript of what would eventually be published posthumously as the Somnium, like the dream, okay? Now, part of the Somnium was to describe what practicing astronomy would be like from the perspective of another planet, okay? Because when you're practicing astronomy, where you are is always critical. You're always describing the stars of where you are, like in longitude, latitude. But now, what if you were doing this from, say, the surface of Mars? And he was doing this to show the feasibility of a non-geocentric system, to say that astronomy is just as valid if you're on Mars, you're still revolving around the sun, so what's the difference, okay? But the manuscript, which kind of disappeared for a while after changing several times, it described a fantastic trip to the moon, and it was part allegory, part autobiography, and part treatise on interplanetary travel, okay? And now this is sometimes, because of this, it's sometimes described as the first work of science fiction. In fact, Carl Sagan called it that, and Isaac Asimov both referred to it as the first work of science fiction.
And also, so, a famous Czech writer here, one of the other father of science fiction, Carl Čapek.
Yeah.
Also made a collect when you told me this, it rung a bell because he actually made that connection to this as well.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. And so very, very interesting. It's like the very birth of science fiction novel writing. Now, this is a really tough situation here because now we're getting close to the peak of the witch trials in Germany, and it has a relation to this story and Kepler's mother. You have to understand Kepler's mother at this particular situation that yeah. fits into the story so that people kind of get an idea that she might be a witch. Years after this story came out, a very distorted version of the story had come to life, which instigated that the witch trial against his mother would start because in this story, Travis, what's interesting about this is that the mother of the narrator in this story consults a demon to learn the means of space travel to get to from Earth to the moon. From Earth to Mars. Now, what's interesting about this is that this story is supposed to be autobiographical mm-hmm. about Kepler. So already yeah. eyebrows are being raised going, wait a minute, hold on. Are you talking yeah. about your real mother here?
Right.
And she kind of fit the bill. I mean, she didn't help herself out. She was antisocial. She was kind of a crotchety old woman. you know, she was into homeopathical sort of herbs and other type of remedies that kind of flew in the eyes of the church.
Uh-huh.
She was rude. She was meddlesome. She got in your business. So, yeah, she didn't fit well into social life in Germany. And, again, this was at the height of the witch trials and the witch burnings
yeah.
Of the 1611 to 1630s.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty rough. So when the charges started stacking up, 49 in all, if you can believe that, they included causing pain without touching people, riding a calf to death, muttering fatal blessings over newborn babies. Yeah, you're going to get it. You're going to get it. Things like that. Unnatural deaths of animals. Trying to talk to a young woman into becoming a witch, like, you mm-hmm. know, incorporating them into maybe a coven. But yet there was one that was true that is still kind of – it's sketchy to hear. But she was heard in a sermon about an archaic tradition of making goblets of deceased relatives' skulls. And she asked a gravedigger for her father's skull so she could do that. And then she would have it inlaid with silver for her son, the famous court mathematician. Here you go, Kepler. This should help things out.
Wait,
here's your grandfather's skull.
You don't have such a goblet?
No.
What?
Yeah. So
you're missing out, man.
Things she did not help herself out during this time.
Yeah.
So into the rescue comes her son.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Kepler's like, all right, this has gone on too far. She's going to be burned alive if I don't step in here.
Almost happened.
Yeah. So following her eventual acquittal, Kepler composed 223 footnotes to the story that he wrote, the science fiction story about traveling from Earth to Mars.
Yeah.
All right, about, you know, a demon transporting this person there. So he wrote these footnotes to kind of back himself up to say this is not a devil-inspired manuscript, by the way, that it's going to be self-explained in allegorical aspects as well as considerable scientific context. So if you can have the court please understand that particularly regarding to lunar geography that's hidden in the text, that this is all science.
Well, this brings us closer to the time when Kepler and Brahe meet, because keep in mind that Kepler was a Lutheran, and in Graz, where he was the state mathematician, Frederick II instituted the Catholic Counter-Reformation, and it made life harder and harder for Protestants. Long story short, Kepler started looking around for another place of employment, and this is not long after Brahe read Kepler's first book, okay? Meanwhile, Brahe sent his own book to people in Rudolf II's court with the wish to present one to Rudolf in person.
So it really, he's kind of his own PR agent in a lot of ways, you know, to try to make this happen.
Yeah, they all sort of are, yeah. Like, both of these stories seems to be kind of the norm at the time, that you write a book and then you publish a couple and you send them to other, almost like a peer-reviewed journal. Like you send them to other great thinkers and then they either like it or don't like it. And then you can publish their letters in your foreword. So it's like a recommendation from, you know, like if you sent one to Galileo and he says, oh, this is great, then, you know, you can build off each other's ideas.
So and then the end game is if you can get actually this promotional item, this work read by somebody that with power and money,
right.
You're in.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So they all sent books to each other, and, you know, and then because when you talk about publishing, you're not publishing to a mass audience, like not, you know, probably in Latin and not everyone would even care about it. But Brahe had his book and he wanted to meet Rudolf in person. And so Rudolf, you know, also really wanted to meet Brahe. So he sent for an invitation for him to come to Bohemia, including the invitation actually had like a salary and a land grant and everything to set up shop. So this was like finally the real deal. And this is what Brahe was waiting for ever since he left Denmark, more or less. And this is kind of interesting that before he came to Prague, Brahe whipped up some medicines in his alchemist lab and to give to Rudolf as a gift. And he made up some, like including some for the plague, which actually kind of came in handy later. But, you know, whipped up some medicines, prepared a bunch of stuff in his lab, and then went to Prague, first just by himself without his, you know, caravan full of stuff. And Brahe was shown Belvedere by Rudolf, which is also known as the Summer Palace. Palace, yeah, which is kind of right next to the Prague Castle. And it's really neat. Like, they say that it's the most beautiful Renaissance building north of the Rhine. So the Belvedere really is a beautiful thing, and it's really intricate and has like a singing fountain where you can hear music and is covered in Greek mythology. And now, because of Brahe, actually has a star chart painted on the ceiling. It was built for the emperor's wife, and so a lot of work went into it. It was kind of like a romantic gift, but unfortunately the wife of the emperor died before the building could be completed, so the emperor actually didn't allow any woman in the building until after his death. Like, he just, you know, he was kind of heartbroken by that. But even though as beautiful as it was, it wasn't good enough for Brahe because it has kind of a wraparound porch and patio and all that, but not really great as an observatory. So, but anyways, he was shown this, and the emperor offered him Bednatki, which is a palace or a castle a little bit further away, and was much better, Brahe's needs much better as an observatory. And he also quickly set up a chemical laboratory, which I read as an alchemist lab. So Bednatki is the Czech word for Venice, because when it floods, it's surrounded by water. So that's kind of fitting. But now this is interesting. So Brahe is already a very wealthy man. And I found in one of my books, I found what his wage was promised to be, which is 1,000 shok a year, which equals 2,000 thaler. So thaler, which is where dollar comes from, that was originally a Czech currency from Joachimsthal, which is now called Jachimov, where the uranium mines were and other things, but also silver mines. So, 2,000 thaler, which is 26,000 crowns, which we still use Czech crowns today, or 60,000 kreutzer, or 360,000 dinars, okay? A Großknecht, which I'm not sure what it is in English, is some kind of like a squire or a higher-ranked peasant, if you will, made 10 a year, so 10 shok, I assume, and a nanny would make 1 a year. So he made 1,000.
So this is absolutely amazing to me. This is amazing. He made 1,000 shok a year compared to what an average blue collar type person.
So yeah, like 1,000 times the average. 10.
Yeah, yeah, 10
or 100 times that. Yeah.
All right. So he's rolling money. To give you an idea, you know, this is higher than most barons or counts ever made in Bohemia. And Rudolf decided that this should be also retroactive since the time that Brahe left his services at the King of Denmark. So he's just rolling in dough. Mm-hmm. And when you're this good in what you do, you're going to get paid for it in a lot of respects. But, I think that it's amazing that the money was coming in. And given the idea, when Kepler arrived in Prague, so now we got a creative mind in a beautiful city, bustling and ripe for these type of learned men to come in and just kind of put their science to the test. Mm-hmm. All right, this is a great cross-section of the perfect time, the perfect place, and here you go, Kepler and Brahe. Prague.
Well, yeah. I mean, people often think of them as a duo, even though they were only together for like 3-4 years from like, you know, 1600. But you have in Prague, you have this great creative mathematical mind together with the astronomer with the most precise charts, right? I mean, that's what makes them so awesome. like as a duo kind of. So you had a lot of potential there. But Prague by itself, we have Jan Jasinski, who we mentioned a couple times, but you know, just to kind of give you a really brief story of who he was, because Jan Jasinski is actually the person that brought Kepler into, basically gave him a ride into the city. And Jan Jasinski, or Jan Jasinius, as he's sometimes known as, was a Protestant. Well, he was a medical professor, but you know, also a doctor, obviously. And he did the first public autopsy, because Catholics wouldn't allow it, but Protestants could do this. So he was also the emperor's personal physician, and he later led the uprising that eventually led to the 30 Years' War. So, you know, very interesting characters kind of in town. Jan Jasinski brought Kepler to Banatki and kind of was a translator kind of person to discuss a contract of employment between Kepler and Brahe. So actually, I found it very interesting that, like, Jan Jasinski, like, I've been down to the torture chambers where he was eventually tortured and then killed. And here I see him, you know, I'm reading a book, and he's actually like the negotiator between Kepler and Brahe. The negotiations of their contract, Kepler and Brahe's, didn't go very well at first. You know, Brahe invited Kepler in, but then kind of, you know, had different expectations. But eventually they came to an agreement. I showed this to you, Pete, actually, when we wandered around the castle. But when Emperor Rudolf sometimes required Tycho to be at court twice a day, and when they did that, they stayed at the Golden Griffin, which is on Newtown, right by the city wall there.
Yeah.
Remember that
yeah.
cobblestone street?
Where,
sure. Yeah, next to the Golden Pear and the fish with two tails.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And it's a very small street today, and I'm sure it wasn't any bigger back then. But that was his residence, right? His residence mm-hmm. for this time. So that was just a stone's throw away from the castle and the royal court. So it wouldn't be that far of a walk.
Yeah, like it was within sight, basically.
Yeah.
Especially in the winter when the trees aren't in the way.
Two times a day to come into is a lot.
Because
a lot
Rudolf, we've done the Rudolf II podcast, and we talked about his superstitions and his weird habits. So mainly what Tycho actually did was read or give him advice based on his horoscopes. Like that was the main thing. And I think we mentioned this before, and it's hard to say how much Kepler and Brahe believed in horoscopes. I know we talked about Kepler before. And it's possible that Tycho believed in this a little bit more than Kepler, but it is clear from his writings that he thought this was boring and tedious. So just kind of, you know, the boring part of his job was to read horoscopes. He definitely believed that free will trumped the influence of the planets. And a lot of astrologers, even ones that did believe in it, believed this, that that there might be some influence, but it just helps you know what the stars say and that there's some kind of influence out there, but your free will, you can overcome them. And if you know your horoscope, even more so because you know what to expect. So,
It's not a far throw from a lot of religious belief systems, especially in Christianity, Catholic or Protestant. Free will plays a huge part in making decisions because you do have free will.
Well, so obviously Tycho believed that predicting battles was ludicrous, right? I mean, there's no way that the stars could say that much. But Rudolf believed in it very strongly, and he was the one paying the bills. So Tycho, you know, yeah.
There you go.
Sure. Now, eventually Kepler lived a few blocks further from the castle. And depending on the source, but I think that's now where there's that statue of Brahe and Kepler. Remember that? It's on Pohojolets.
It's right by the
square.
Tram stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you get off at Pohojolets, kind of the back door of the castle, you'll see a statue of Brahe and Kepler. That may have been Kepler's house at one point. Now it's just kind of a green little lawn. But
Brahe mounted some of his instruments on the balcony of the Belvedere or the Summer Palace and used it as an observatory, which is a great perch on top of the hill near the castle. I mentioned this early in the podcast, too, when we talked about how these folks, you know, Kepler or Brahe did a lot of this stuff with or without optics, and you mentioned that, especially Brahe, being the older one of the two, did not do this stuff with optics.
Right.
But Kepler did. He dabbled in optics, you know, mm-hmm. and lenses, and used what he knew, which was how the eye works, right? Mm-hmm. So he used the idea of a camera obscura to draw the solar eclipse. Kepler, which we all learned in elementary school,
yeah,
right. So we don't burn our eyeballs right off when we go look at solar eclipse. We build a shoe box and we put the mirrors in so we don't burn our eyes out. But the Kepler discovered how the eye works in this manner. Before this was thought, the image was caught into liquid in the eye. Some sort of people thought that really how it worked. But Kepler realized that it was reflected upside down in the back of the eye through a lens. So when we talk about, you know, where do you really see, we see through the back of our brain, not through the front. And it's flipped. It's inverted.
Right.
So he used these theories to describe how a telescope works. And his work became the foundation of the 17th century optics tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So according to Hasner, Kepler was there when he died, and it was Brahe's dying wish for Kepler to finish his model, his model theory, that is.
Yeah. Yeah, because Brahe kept working on the Tychonian model, right? So it's still geocentric, but the planets revolving around the Earth, around the Sun. And the thing is that there were some trust issues in the beginning because, especially when in the negotiations of employment and these things, Kepler had to be very careful about the heliocentric, geocentric kind of his belief systems, because he knew what Brahe believed in. But Kepler was a strong Copernican, like he knew that the sun was in the middle. So he kind of tiptoed around this for a long time. But in the end, Brahe realized that if he wanted to see his Tychonian model of the solar system finished and published, he would have to trust Kepler to do it after his death, right? So in the end, he did. And once they got over that, they worked together. And this is the great famous duo that we know of, you know, them, you know, Tycho having all the data and Kepler being the mastermind behind all the, like, the formulas and the math behind the model. But that does bring us to Brahe's death. And this is a story that we actually get from Kepler. There's been a lot of speculation over this story over the years, and that's actually part of the reasons why he was exhumed a couple times. But according to Kepler, so just outside the castle, Brahe was invited to a banquet. Now, at the time, it was considered rude to rise from the table before the host, right? So, you know, when the host is seating, you stay sit. This one simple rule killed Brahe, according to Kepler. So he ate and drank heavily, but he refused to break etiquette. And apparently, the host had a bladder of steel. So the host never got up. And Tycho really had to go, but he refused to break etiquette, right?
This sounds like a bad college drinking game.
Yeah. So in any case, by the time he got home, you know, he just kind of ran home, and he's been holding it for so long that he could no longer urinate. Like, he tried, nothing came out. So he tried for days, but eventually some 5 days later, I mean, he just, you know, he was suffering quite a bit. And on his last night, his delirium stopped, and his last words were, he looked over at Kepler and said, "Let me not seem to have lived in vain." Okay? And then he passed away. So he's buried in tin. I think we mentioned that. He was placed in a magnificent casket in a procession and brought to Tin Church, which is right off of Old Town Square, which, again, pictures
are... You can't miss it. It is basically landmark that everybody sees in every postcard. It's a very medieval looking church with the two spires, and it looks like maybe something you might see from an old fairy tale, but it's right there in the middle of Old Town Square.
Yeah. There's pictures on your website too on Bohemican. So
absolutely.
No, we already covered the model that Tycho and Kepler were after, which mostly Tycho. Kepler was a pretty strict Galileo Copernican. But so, you know, again, Tycho had his own ideas, and you mentioned before that it's just basically based on the fact that the stars don't move, you don't see any parallax, so therefore the Earth doesn't move, and so on. There was another thing that we didn't mention last time, was that the Earth can't move, since everyone knows that out in space is ether. It's like quintessence. There's no vacuum. Vacuum is a vacuum was actually heresy at the time, because there cannot be nothing, because God is everywhere, therefore something must be everywhere, right? So vacuums didn't exist, and since everything's moving through the ether, the world is just too damn big and sluggish to kind of squeeze through the ether. It just wouldn't make sense. Like, this was part of their thought process here. So anyways, that's, you know, these are part of the arguments for geocentric, like, you know, as in the Earth is in the middle of the universe and the sun revolves around the Earth. That was some of the arguments. But so after Brahe died, Kepler became Rudolf's court mathematician, which is probably, he's probably most famous for that today. Well, not most famous, but he is known as Rudolf's court mathematician. He had full use of Brahe's tools and charts, and he was able to complete the Rudolfine tables and with them create better horoscopes. But the Rudolfine tables are actually something that he's really, really famous for, because they are, simply put, the most precise star charts and kind of maps of everything that were ever created to that point. And they're actually, I mean, he had very strict standards, and, you know, Brahe worked on them forever, years and years, and then Kepler finally finished them at some point.
But yet there were still some discoveries yet to be made. And we talked about, at the same time, Galileo Galilei in Italy was discovering some of these amazing earth-shattering concepts through his telescope. At one point, Galileo's news reached Kepler that Galileo had discovered four moons orbiting around Jupiter. Kepler's response: surely Jupiter has inhabitants that, you know, that mm-hmm. could enjoy yeah. this, because God would not want this to go unseen by just a handful of people, right? Surely, yeah. surely not that.
Why would God create moons if there's
exactly. no? Things go on for Kepler, of course. When he left Prague for Linz, he moved around quite a bit during the 30 Years' War, which kind of threw Europe into a huge quagmire of loss and battle and war weariness. So he came back to Prague. He did see Jasinski's head on a pike on the Charles Bridge, which would not be uncommon for enemies of the state to be decapitated and put on a pike and put above right on the tower mm-hmm. on Charles Bridge.
Yeah.
Not a good thing to see.
So eventually, Kepler passed away, and on the night he died, there was a meteor shower, which is fitting, I suppose. Yeah. His epitaph, which he wrote himself, reads, "I measured the heavens, now the earth's shadow I measure. Skybound my mind, earthbound my body rests." Carl Sagan described, I think we mentioned this when he, with the science fiction story, that Carl Sagan actually describes Kepler as the first astrophysicist and the last scientific astrologer. So he definitely has a kind of important place in history. Kepler was actually on an East German stamp.
You know, and Travis, in 2009, NASA named Kepler Mission for Kepler's contributions to the field of astronomy, and with that Kepler Space Telescope. And maybe we'll actually find that those mystical inhabitants of Jupiter that we're looking at those moon, looking at the four moons, maybe they do exist. All right. In New Zealand, Forland National Park, there's also a range of mountains named after Kepler, the so-called mm-hmm. Kepler Mountains, and a three-day walking trail known as the Kepler Track to the mountains of the same name. Maybe we saw those in Lord of the Rings. Is that possible? Because we're talking New Zealand.
Yeah,
so
maybe.
So maybe every time you look at all those great grandiose scenes on Lord of the Rings on your Blu-ray or your digital download, you see Kepler's mountain range.
I didn't make the connection. Maybe. Yeah, I don't know what mountain range they're.
Kind of interesting.
New Zealand's full of mountains, so maybe not. But yeah. Yeah, there's a lot more that was named after him.
Oh, what about the moon near Tycho?
Well, the thing is that every time, because of the Kepler Space Telescope, if they find another planet or a moon or something, they call it like Kepler 29b. That's one that's Earth-like, or, you know, Kepler whatever. Like I'm one of my RSS feeds is the NASA Kepler mission, and then every time they find a planet, it's Kepler something.
Nice.
So actually, he gets a lot of stuff named after him.
And it's not just Kepler. Brahe also has some things named after him too.
Yeah, like the crater Tycho,
well,
on the moon.
It's actually,
right?
You know, it's mispronounced. We mispronounce it in English as Tycho.
That's what I was thinking. Like the moon crater is actually
right. You know, it's Tycho
spelling,
crater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As also, he has a crater on Mars called, you know, Tycho Brahe, or probably Tycho Brahe. I don't know how we butcher that one, but there's the Tycho Brahe Planetarium in Copenhagen, which makes sense. And then it's called HEAT 1X-Tycho Brahe is the name of a manned private spacecraft to be launched by Copenhagen Suborbitals, like this company. But there's a couple other things, like a bar in Zagreb and a, you know, ferry operating between Sweden and Denmark. So, you know, I mean, his you'll see his name around too. And we actually have some listener mail this time by a guy named Kurt. He's written in a couple times. And one of his questions was, that.
First he enjoys a podcast. So let's get that out.
I'll read his email. Actually, he says, "Hey, Travis and Pete, been enjoying your podcast up to date. Can you tell me how or if Copernicus fits into this discussion and his revolution on the cosmos in the 16th century?" All right, and then he thanks us both for our hard work, which is mostly me and less
air quotes. Pete Coleman. we did mention that though. I mean, there's a lot. We talked about the Copernicus theory. The concepts that Kepler really kind of really focused on. So yeah, Kurt. Yeah, there's a lot of connections with Copernicus here.
Yeah, especially the reason we got this mail maybe a month or two ago, but I saved it for this one because it's really fitting because you know when we talk about like Ptolemy or the geocentric model, they weren't stupid. They based it off observations. So both Ptolemy and Copernicus's model work. The difference is, I mean, what I mean by they work is that when you predict where a planet will be based on both models, that prediction will come true. Mars will be where you say it will be. Just the math behind it is very different. Like the why it works is very, very different. So again, Tycho did not believe in Copernicus and Kepler did. So this is really that time, the turn of the 17th century, when you see that shift. And Copernicus and his theories were huge in all of this. I mean, these were debated all around universities. And Kepler's university, officially, they had to teach the Ptolemaic model, like the geocentric model, but all the professors knew better. And all the professors, you know, secretly, quietly, would also teach Copernicus. So it was pretty interesting. I mean, one thing I want to point out is, you said this with if Galileo and Kepler would just talk more, because Galileo knew what inertia was. Kepler didn't. And so Kepler was pointing at gravity, calling it like the Holy Spirit force, you know?
Right.
And if they just would have talked between Galileo and Kepler, they would have come up with gravity. Definitely.
There'd be no need for Newton.
Before Newton. So it's really interesting. So Galileo had a lot more proof than Copernicus did. So, but they were, you know, they still had Copernicus's model that kind of based off of a hunch and some math. They assumed it was right, and then they were looking for proof. So without Copernicus, you wouldn't have had this search. So, you know, this is the definition of science, that you have a hypothesis. You have two hypotheses. One is the geocentric, one is heliocentric, and then you look for evidence. So you look for empiricism. Galileo, he had, like, he found, for instance, the phases of Venus, right? Or which was only possible through optics. So Copernicus didn't have this, but he ended up being right. Again, even the phases of Venus, it could have also proved Tycho right, meaning that the Earth doesn't move, but the planets revolve around the Sun. As long as the planets revolve around the Sun, you get phases of Venus. So it's interesting that Tycho could have actually pointed to that and said, no, I'm right too, or I'm really right. Kepler just kind of, part of the reason that he went along with it was a theological basis. So he thought that his theological models fit Copernicus more than his theological models would fit some ancient Greek philosopher that, you know, was a pagan, and you know, so kind of interesting. It's really the why and the how that wasn't pondered before in the way it was before Kepler that finally put the nail in the Ptolemaic coffin, if you will. So, Copernicus is all over this. So, I mean, it's a great question. Just to go back to that Carl Sagan model that you know, he was the last kind of astrologer and the first astronomer. And this, again, is without Copernicus, it's hard to see how this would happen. Because if you have a different model and you want better horoscopes, you look at the stars to get better readings, and which leads to science, even if all you're after is horoscope. Yeah, so basically, in short, I mean, Copernicus is central to this whole time period because even now, we define Brahe and Kepler and even Galileo by comparing them and contrasting them to Copernicus. Copernicus is really the base model for all these thinkers. I mean, so in many ways, I mean, I don't want to make him out to a bigger genius than he was. I mean, he clearly was a product of his time. But, you know, we're always, if we talk about Galileo, we talk about Copernicus as well. And if we contrast his idea with Tycho, we're contrasting it with Copernicus's model. So it's, sure, I mean, he was central in many ways. So
great question, Kurt, and please keep the emails coming.
Absolutely.
We'll definitely put them on the podcast.
So today I'll mention the bibliography because I came across a very interesting book, which was by Josef Hassner, which was called Tycho Brahe und J. Kepler in Prague. It was a German book printed in 1873, and it was really just about their meeting in Prague, and it was written... The reason I thought it was so interesting is because it was written in German, but by a Bohemian German. So there were many kind of terms that I didn't really know before, and just the way that he took Bohemian money for granted, and you know, which I've never heard a schock before, or you know, taler in context. Like I knew that dollar came from taler, but it was a great read. And then the other one that was a really great help was Kitty Ferguson's Tycho and Kepler, which was a really thick, all-inclusive book, which I would recommend if you want to read more about this subject. In fact, one thing that I really loved about that book was the great explanation of the models, all three. There was good pictures that it would explain why Ptolemy's model would predict the where the planets are and you know where the stars would be and where the moon would be and everything, even though it was completely wrong, why it would still be correct, why it would still give correct predictions. That was really interesting to read about, which we just skimmed over very quickly, and the book's much more in depth. And another thing that was really cool was reading about Tycho's island on Hven. Like, if you had all the money in the world and you were creating an observatory with an alchemist lab in it, that's what you would do. You would model his thing. It was just incredible. Like, brass instrument and golden globes with stars in them and murals and all these huge things. Everything's, like, symmetrical and, you know, geometric, and it's just incredible. And it was an island. I mean, it's just really, really cool to read about.
One thing from this podcast that struck me during the
Drunken Moose.
Well, yeah, I love the Drunken Moose. Who would not love the Drunken Moose that fell down the stairs and died? But no, I think that one thing that really struck me about Kepler and Brahe in this podcast was Brahe's sort of life in this time where Brahe was had this entourage of students and people that helped him be who he was, and it was you can almost see the eyes rolling. I don't know if they were upset with him, but you know, he was making so much money and he was so demanding as a person that I think that it would have put anybody to the test. And yeah. I think that he had an army of these people that would just do anything he asked them to do. And I kind of wonder, you know, what seeds of discovery, what seeds of knowledge did he impart to these people that were kind of lost to history? What did they do with their knowledge? Who did they talk to? Did it just die with them after he passed away?
Yeah, some of his students had theories, because he has many, many students, and he would cycle through them so that anyone could actually claim too much of
his knowledge set?
Yeah. And there were some students that did. And they would even falsify some of the star charts and everything, and then later claim that it was their idea, not Brahe's. And sometimes I get the impression from reading this that sometimes maybe it was, and just Brahe had much more money to fight it. Like in the, you know, just like you think of,
oh, it's a battle of intellectual property.
I was just going to say, yeah. So you know, if you got better lawyers to defend your patent, it's not too different. But in some case, he clearly had to deal with intellectual property thieves, if you will, and you know, students that would run away and publish a book really quickly that ended up being very wrong because they were clearly stealing an idea and just wanted to get it out there first. But he was fighting this all the time. And there was even people that ended up in Rudolf's court before Brahe was that he had to fight and say, no, this was my idea. You're dealing with a charlatan or a fraud. And if you want the truth behind the idea, you got to bring me to Prague. So, yeah, really interesting stuff. Yeah, thanks for listening. I know today was kind of a long one.
But a great ride.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of interesting stuff. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, other episodes, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter at Alchemy Podcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.